Thanks for opening up the toolkit. I'm your host, Justin Fortier. Today's guest, house music DJ and producer Sid, joined me to talk about sustaining a career in music, starting his new label, and the steps required to be able to perform music in front of crowds around the world. Sid is an incredible producer who has put out songs with Cascade, Don Diablo, Loud Luxury, and a number of official remixes for artists like Diplo, Lizzo, and Ellie Goulding. With over 100 million plays on Spotify and frequent appearances on top playlists and radio shows, his music does very well commercially, but he also embraces a more underground side for some of his touring, playing top house music clubs in addition to a circuit of larger festivals. I had a great time recording this episode and learned a lot about the music business from his authentic answers. To learn more about Sid, check him out at Sid Music on Instagram. In preparation for our conversation, I listened to a great interview done by Will Joy that goes over the beginning of Sid's career. Rather than me repeating a similar interview, I went deeper into Sid's career and will link to the episode on his starting out in the show notes alongside the links to listen to Sid's music. Now please enjoy my conversation with Sid. I was hoping we could start with behind the scenes on your remix of Labyrinthia and Diplo's track Audio that earned you a Grammy nomination. How does a remix like that come about, or that specific remix happen, and what are some of the pieces that move to give you that opportunity and then make the track?
So I think for that one, that was, I think I'd say about 2 years ago around this time. It was the first, like, Diplo was somebody obviously who, like, I always looked up to, and but never really, like, supported me for, like, just because I guess he wasn't aware of my music. And I'd say it was about 2 years ago he started playing this song that I did called Bad For Me, which was an original that I put out on Hexagon, Don Diablo's label. And I think my, you know, it's one of those things, you don't really know how you get into people's radar, but I'm pretty sure that was it. He was playing that song a lot. And then we just, obviously I'd seen the Sia project, and I mean the LSD project. And the request came in, you know. Sometimes it's, in my experience, it's always been better having it that way. Having the artist or the label reach out to you as opposed to me being like, oh, I just heard this new single, I want to remix it. Because it puts you in a different negotiating position as far as like fee and them being more like excited about it. So that one, it was just like, and there's been other ones as well. Now as things have grown, like we're getting more on that side of them, you know, requesting me. So yeah, with that one, it was just that. And, you know, when I'm creating it, it's like, you know, just kind of, you're not thinking of what it's going to be or what it's going to do. You're just kind of making something cool. And that was my idea. Just like, you know, I love the original and kind of make it something that I could play in my sets and stuff. And that's how it went.
When you're starting with a remix of a track, do you approach it by listening to the song first? Or I heard MK in an interview say that he would always just start straight with the stems and not even listen to the whole track so he wouldn't be influenced. How do you approach something like that?
It's different every time. You know, a lot of times what I'm getting sent is the track. And then if I'm cool with, I think I can come up with something, then I'll go back and ask for the stems. But, you know, so it's different. I mean, I think that one, it was probably a situation where I had gotten just the full track and like messed with it a little. And then from there kind of went with it. Cause I kept the same chords in that. And I think that was the main thing. Like, obviously it's all original new sounds. There's some like really cool effect stuff, like bedding sounds that I kept. So it's varies. It's like, it's different every time.
Yeah. And when you were talking about Diplo's support of a track, I know you've had involvement with the 1001 track list. Is that something that you're watching, your management's watching to see where your tracks are popping up, or is it usually more informal, or do DJs let each other know when they play each other's songs? Is it some combination of all that?
People who are kind of, that I have a relationship with, usually let me know. A lot, definitely like 1001. I've been friends with those guys for years, you know, and it's amazing to see what they've built over there. And it's become the, you know, like the benchmark for how a song is doing, especially for a club record. You know, Beatport is Beatport, and Spotify as far as, but that doesn't really directly relate to who's playing your music, how many people are playing it. So, yeah, I mean, there's definitely been situations where I see, oh, X played this track on 1001. Let me reach out to them and try to like create a relationship there.
On 1001's track list, I noticed that especially artists like you, Valentino Khan, Don Diablo, perform really well, actually, across festivals as well. Is that something that you were always interested in, or is that just the type of music you think that a wider array of artists are interested in playing your sounds at, like kind of the horn type sound or the lead in yours? I think, is that something you're thinking about or were thinking about at the beginning when you design tracks? Was it festivals or was it always club focused?
I kind of do both. Some music is definitely more festival driven. I'm not like specifically, I think early on in my career, I was trying to make, because I think this is like that first phase is like, oh, I want these DJs to play my music. So I think that established me early on as far as like getting a really large, diverse kind of group of DJs playing my music. I think my music kind of fits in like, a, you know, it's not a very specific, narrow sound. It's kind of something that I think a lot of different DJs can play. So I think that had a lot of like effect on that too.
Yeah. The first episode I did of this show was with Rob McDaniels, who's the CEO of Beatport. And he talked about how he kind of viewed the DJ as the new platform, something like streaming or radio, of like the DJ as a selector is something that Beatport obviously sees a lot of value in. In terms of the different promotion methods, do you think you've seen more uptick in a fan base from other DJs playing your track or something like a song taking off on Spotify? Because kind of one's a very small group of people that need to know about your music that push it out, and then the other is just Austin Kramer.
Yeah, that's the thing. So I've had both. I mean, I think as a new artist, DJ, producer, you're going to have the most success through an artist driven label. Like that's the most important thing, right? This DJ is going to co-sign you by putting out your song on his label, but that doesn't necessarily guarantee that it's going to do well on Spotify. You know, if that artist and that label have a big fan base, it's going to get you fans. But then I've had on the other side of it, I've seen what's possible, and with as far as Spotify, and we know, you know, playlisting is super important, but I've had, again, this one bad for me. It was one that I really believed in, that I was like, I think this is going to go. It's, you know, it's a cool vocal. It's got melody in it. But it wasn't one that was heavily supported in the playlist on Spotify, but it was this weird thing where kind of the algorithm kind of just started working it, because people were sharing it, people were playing it, and it grew in that world, and I saw a whole different kind of fan base just from that. So I think early on, key is definitely DJ cosign label support for sure.
When you're going on tour or you want to get booked at a club or a festival, where do you see the bigger factor or the contributing factor? Is it possible to get booked at clubs with just Spotify plays, or are the promoters there looking at the DJ network too?
Is it? Yeah, I think it has more to do with, I think Spotify, as far as touring, because there can be such a disconnect. You can have a song that blows up on Spotify, but those people just are fans of this song and not you as an artist. So that's been, I think, in the current state of music, that's the biggest problem, is how do you get these people to become your fans? And that means them being like, okay, how I'm going to go to this guy's Instagram or this guy's Twitter and see what he's about. And then if they like you, then they'll follow you. So I think it has more to do with your socials and the fan base you built on that side rather than the success of one song. And yeah, I think promoters still kind of, they definitely still look at Beatport for clubs. I think they my experience is they really value their community and who their community is talking about. So I think number one, if it's like a new artist who is like in that questionable state, like, is this guy going to come and sell tickets or sell nothing? I think people in their community coming to the promoters being like, oh, we want to see this guy is really important. And again, you know, the cosign and everything, I think helps the most. And let me add, I'm going to add one more thing. So the one experience for me was I played a show in Japan like 2 years ago, maybe. And it was right after, maybe a couple months after I'd put out the EP that I did on Hexagon. Bad from EP. That was one of those situations where I had already done some stuff with Don Diablo, with Hexagon, but it had been a while. And I swear, man, it was like, it was a sold out show. Half the crowd had Hexagon merch on. Like, yeah. And it was just like one of those obvious things. It's like, okay, that was the right move to do that because, you know, it was in other parts of the world. Like, this is getting me all these fans that I didn't have before.
That was actually perfect. Led into something I was thinking about with labels. There's the big labels, we'll get to talking about your label later, but Hexagon, and I'd say to some extent Dirty Bird in the US, they're labels that are smaller in terms of maybe even overall plays. Dirty Bird especially, it's much smaller, but
even Claude Von Stroke, the label's owner, only gets about 500,000 plays a month
on Spotify, but they're able to convert that to sold out like 10,000 person events twice a year and all this other stuff that the label is really putting on in terms of they've got a super loyal community. And I wanted to talk a bit about how you end up in Asia. Is that through Hexagon? I've seen you do a lot of tours over there. What
I mean, look, this whole thing, it's still based around gatekeepers. Like, you know, the things happen in different order, but usually you get a manager, then you get an agent, and you want an agent who's excited about you. And for US, I've been with the same agent since the beginning, really. But for Asia, I switched maybe a couple of years ago, and I went with this smaller agency, and they're really the ones who have the contacts. You know, I don't, my first run around, it's like, I don't know anyone in fucking Japan who's going to want to book me. And yeah, like there's some artists who have that like ability to go out there, find these people and have them bring them out. But the right way is you have an agent, the agent has the contacts. And then you start building and establishing those relationships yourself. And that's how that works for sure.
When selecting an agent, is that something you worked with your manager on? How does that process go about? Also, if you could talk a bit about how you came in contact with your manager, selected, how that's worked out. I think that's probably for younger artists who are thinking about, who are finally starting to get some traction. That's a huge decision, and it looks like it.
So obviously my story is a little different than most people, but I'd been DJing, producing, and then I started producing for other people. And then I got to the point where I was like, I don't want to do this. I feel like I'm not getting kind of the attention I deserve on my own stuff. And I want to focus on that. And I met this lawyer who I didn't know at the time was Cascade's lawyer. So he first thing he did was ask Cascade about me, and Cascade was playing one of my tracks. And this lawyer took me on as a client, and that his first thing was, you need a manager. So, you know, this is my experience. There's a million different ways, but I think the key is get a manager. And, you know, if it's a good manager, they're going to have the contacts. They have other artists, they have who are up with all different agents. So for in my, what ended up happening for me was I kind of met to a bunch of different managers and stuff. And then I ended up going with Stephanie LaFera, who's Little Empire, who at the time was managing Cascade. So the whole concept for me, this was, again, the whole concept of the cosign. It's like Cascade, like, messes with my stuff, and I think this is a good place for me to be. So I ended up signing with his agent because it made sense. But then on the other side, it's, you know, it can be someone else recommending you or an agency that reaches out to you. You know, as you start establishing, there's definitely going to be people who are going to do it the other way. So for my agent for Europe and Asia, this was because originally what I did was I signed with William Morris for the world, even though my agent was in the U.S. And I felt like he's been killing it for me in the U.S., but I felt like I wanted something a little smaller for Europe and for Asia. So it was an agency that had been wanting to work with me for a little while, and I said, let's do it, you know, and they've really kind of been able to do a lot for me and help grow me in those markets.
Was the sound matching, was that important for you in terms of when you started working with Stephanie, you saw she was working with Cascade, you know the sound was alignment, you knew she was well-educated on the type of music you were going to be creating in the future and getting you in with some of the right spaces. Have you seen any managers or artist combinations where it maybe didn't make sense of what the match was, but it still worked out? Or is the music, do you think some managers don't get the music properly?
Yeah, I mean, everything goes back to having the right context and everything. You know, if you're a manager who does all bass artists and you sign a house artist, you're going to have some trouble. You know, you're trying to play songs on the right like the right house labels because you don't have those contacts. So yes and no. I mean, you know, look at someone like Moshe Elizi, who's done Marshmallow and now he's doing Alesso and stuff. So, I mean, as far as I think there can be some combinations that are not going to work out for sure, as far as manager and artist.
In one of my previous episodes of the podcast, I had on a New York City comedian, Jared Fried, where he talked about stand-up when he's actually performing live as a room. That's kind of the focal point of his career. All the podcasts, the shows, anything that he does with TV, it's all kind of to drive a stand-up audience where he gets to be funny for money, as he said. Is there a focal point for you, or do you see producing as supporting being a DJ? How do you think about that?
I think about this all the time. They both work with each other. Like, they both work hand in hand, I think. You need the music to get people excited. Number one, to show your management, your agents, that you have something to promote. So you constantly need to be putting out music to get these shows in, to play the shows, to, in a way, create new fans who are going to go back and either are already listening to your music or get new fans that are going to listen to your music. So I think with DJing, they're both 50-50 for sure.
Have you noticed any change over time? Has any of that balance shifted? It seems like you, in the past, you might have been able to be a DJ a little bit more without making as many tracks. Somebody like Carl Cox hasn't made as many tracks over time. But now it seems like the producer element is key. Is that a fair assessment of how you've seen it?
I think in more underground dance genres, people value the DJ more than whatever the hell they're putting out as music. But you have to understand, like, it's very hard to break in that world. You know, it's a lot more about, it's like a mini club of friends, and it's very hard to get into. You know, like, the Martinez brothers aren't necessarily DJs that you really ever went to like through their music. Like, you became fans of them because of their sets, you know, that's their thing.
Yeah.
But I think in more, slightly more commercial genres, even like tech house, it's very much driven by the producer side of it, for sure. And then it just becomes this kind of cycle that it's like, put out music, people see you, you start building that way. So, yeah.
In the balance of putting out tracks and people finding you through your music and doing more commercial stuff, you now have a label, Night Service Only. How do you decide when you want to be working on more commercial stuff and when you want to be putting out tracks on your own label now that you have that?
Yeah. I mean, so the whole branding behind the label is Night Service Only. So that, I really wanted to create something that, and I had the name already for maybe a year or two before I launched it or really wanted to put it out. But that's kind of the idea, is like, this is only club stuff. Like, I'm not going to put out any vocal through the label because it doesn't make sense. That's the main purpose of that. You know, I think I went through this weird kind of cycle where I've had some more success with some of the more melodic vocal stuff. But in reality, like, you know, I am a club DJ, and that's kind of, most of my sets is, you know, 80% that. So it's, you know, it could kind of confuse the listener, like, what do you do? But at the same time, like, you know, I have people who love the vocal stuff and then love the club stuff. I have people who love the club stuff and I'll put out a vocal record. It doesn't really, they're not like, oh my God, you put out this vocal, gross. Like, you know, it's kind of one of those things. And the people, and I think we've come to this point in the US especially, where like, people want more club music, you know? Yeah, sure. The streams are not going to be the same, but it's the same thing. Like, you, what you said about Dirty Bird, it's like, it's not music that people are going to be sitting at home or listening to 10 times in a row, but they're going to want to hear that song live in a club or at a festival, for sure.
Yeah. My girlfriend's been protesting a bit because I often try to play that music 10 times in a row at home. And I think the other night she said, can we do something a little bit more relaxing? So,
no.
On Night Service Only, when you started it up, before you launched your radio show on Diplo's Revolution. How did you go about landing that? Was that an aftermath of the remix you did for him, or?
So the idea for Night Service Only, I had the original thing was, it was just, I wanted to eventually, so I was just, I feel like we're at this point now where everyone has kind of launched their own label. You know, there's a lot of DJs who now just have their own label, right? And it's this weird, for me, it was like finding the right moment to do it, where you feel like you can make a difference, because you need to have, again, you want to be at a certain point where you can help young, smaller artists grow. So for me, me and my team had been toying about the idea for the label side. And then I originally had a conversation with Spinin, because we thought we can get Spinin on board, that's this huge marketing machine behind the label. And at first they're like, yeah, that could be cool. And I was like, all right. And then I was like, fuck, you know, maybe it's not the right time. And then my manager reached out to Spinin and they were like, yeah, we want to do this. I was like, okay. So that jump started it for me as far as like, let's do this now. I think it'll be a good time. We have them behind us. Like, even though it doesn't affect the branding of the label necessarily, it's going to open us up to all these fans because they're going to, you know, promote it and stuff. And around that same time that we started negotiating that deal, I think, you know, Stephanie, she had, again, you know, she has other artists who have really successful radio shows. And, you know, we had talked about the idea of doing it. And I think I was either at 80 or at a festival when I was with the SiriusXM guys. And I just brought it up. I was like, hey, like, launching this brand, like, I'd love to do a radio show. And they were like, yeah, let's do it. And then Stephanie, she has the same, you know, she's very close with them also. And they were like, yeah, we're down to do this. But there was this weird transition period because SiriusXM, that second channel was, what was it called? Electric Area. So when they cut Electric Area and went to Diplo's Revolution, a lot of people's radio shows got taken off. So we didn't know what was going to happen. And luckily, again, yeah, it was the relationship that Stephanie and we had with Diplo, like the name recognition with him as far as my stuff. And they were like, yeah, let's do this. So that's kind of how that came about.
On the radio thing, since this is called the Toolkit, what do you use to put together your radio show? I think I've seen some Instagram stories where you're putting it together. Do you typically do that in a music production software, or do you mix it live like you're a DJ and record that?
The intro I made, like, just in Ableton, so, and I have that in a template. And then for the guys at Diplo's Revolution, they sent me, they had gotten done like a bunch of like, I guess, like branded liners. Like, you know, you're listening to Night Service Only. So I have those. So basically, you know, I'd never really done this before. My approach was, I'll do the first show and then I'll turn that into a template. So I do it in Ableton. And what I do is, I don't know why, but in like a plain, in an empty project, I'll do the whole mix. And then import that into the template, rearrange all where the vocal drops need to go. And then I use Audition actually to do my voiceovers. So like for my intro and like when I, you know, do like the sit selection and stuff, I do that in Audition just because it's so easy.
And what is Ableton's digital audio workstation for the listeners who don't know, which is how you put together songs? And what's Audition?
Audition is, it's like what a lot of people use for podcasts and for radio shows and stuff. So it's super easy to just record audio into it. And it has these like amazing presets that you can just click a button and it does like all the necessary stuff to make you sound like, to make you sound sexy.
Awesome.
But yeah, you should check it out too for the show, because you can, it just, you know, normalizes everything and just makes it sound good. So yeah, then I take that audio, export it into Ableton, and then place it where I need to.
Yeah, I mix this currently in Ableton, which is Overkill, but I just had it because I was messing around. On Ableton, in the Will Joy podcast, you talked about how your first tool you started out with was Reason, and then you started playing around with Logic. How did you come about choosing which platform or which tool you're going to make music on?
So I had two older brothers that my oldest brother was always kind of the more musician one, and he always had random shit at home, like drum machines and keyboards and stuff. And he had a PC and he had Reason on it, I think. I want to say that that's how it was. And so that's what I was, and it was just seemed like the thing to use. Logic was also at the time like a lot more expensive and you couldn't, impossible to crack. So, yeah. and Reason, I think, yeah, I don't think I ever paid for Reason at the beginning. Sorry guys. But yeah, so it was just that, it was like, it was what I had and what I could use. And I, you know, and it was, it's kind of, Reason is more like, feels like a little bit of, it's a lot of really successful producers use it, but kind of feels more like a game in a way, like the way it's laid out. So That's how I started. I know a lot of guys have started in Reason. Now it's just Ableton has taken over, and it's such an easy DAW to use that like that's for the majority people's first DAW.
Does that make it easier to collaborate with others because you use Ableton, or when you collaborate, I don't know, the Vinny track you did, Take Your Place, is that, have you ever done a collab with someone who's using a different DAW where they're just exporting the audio?
So Vinny, sick Brazilian producer, and we, for that one, he's in FL Studio. So, you know, I think before Ableton was already around, but FL Studio, and it still is, like that's kind of was like the DAW that people started up in, but it's such a powerful DAW that people still will stay using it. So for that one, he just rendered out stems, sent those to me. I imported them into Ableton, and then I worked on it there and then finished it. So sometimes if it's a song that I'm starting with somebody in the room together, and we're both in the same DAW, usually I'll just save the project, send it to them, and then we can just save new versions of it and go back and forth that way. If it's something that's kind of created online, it's usually stems, just because it's easier. You don't have to worry about somebody missing plugins or anything.
I'm going to move back just a bit to when we were talking about Night Service Only and Spinning. I don't know too much about the music industry, but it looks like a lot of these artist-driven labels are connected to these well-established big labels. What is Night Service Only in relation to Spinning, and what were some of the other choices or thoughts going in your head when you said, I want to start a label?
Yeah, so at the end of the day, it's my label, but I have like an administration deal with Spinning. So they're handling for me all the contracting. They're handling all the promo. They're handling, you know, they'll help me with it, some A&R stuff. I think everything I put out so far was just something, you know, something that I brought in, but you know, they're actually, or maybe not, I can't remember, but, so you're giving up a percentage of your earnings to Spinning for them to tap into their network. And obviously for me, so my thinking was I can go completely independent, grow this myself, or I could tap into their marketing, their social media posts. And at the beginning, especially for my stuff, because they've, you know, I've released with them already, there's familiarity there. They're gonna post on their socials and post on their Instagram. So that was for me the deciding factor. It's like I feel like I can grow this in 3 years, or I can grow this in 1 year to a slightly bigger level than it would be off the bat with their help. So that's what it was for me. I think we're at this point where, you know, if you have the budget, if you have the time, you don't necessarily need a label like this. You can go to a distributor, get like, you know, 15%. Deal and really do it yourself. You know, I'm lucky where I have on my management team Daniel, who's my manager and does most of my day-to-day stuff. He's also had a lot of experience on the label side. Originally it was Trevor, which I kind of got lucky in this way. So Trevor was my day-to-day before, who was more of a marketing guy, and he helped me a lot with the original ideas for the branding and stuff. And he ended up, you know, getting sick and tired of working with me. No, I'm just kidding. But he, you know, ended up transitioning to something else. And then Daniel came in, who was more of like a label, came from the label side, like independent label side. So he's been able to help me kind of, you know, just tee up a lot of this stuff with Spinning. So the thing is, if it's just you creating a label, there is a lot of work to be done. There's a lot of resources you need. So I, you know, the more I'm kind of in this with Spinning, it's like, you know, they just alleviate a lot of those, that time and read things that we would maybe need to hire somebody full time to do this, you know?
Yeah. And those are things that I'm sure take you away from producing and DJing and being able to focus on making great stuff. When you're doing A&R for your label, how are you, I guess, developing or thinking or finding tracks or people to work with? DMs or what's the method that people get in contact with you?
I'm on this front, man. I'm kind of scatterbrained and it's tough to do everything. Like, you know, every Monday I do my radio show. Like I lose a whole day essentially between, you know, my whole goal is like, I want people to come to the show to discover new stuff. I don't just want to play shit that's out there. So that's a whole day. Obviously then I need to focus on producing and everything. So I've been kind of, I go through demo emails and if somebody DMs me 90% of the time, I answer and I listen to the song, maybe closer to a 99%. So far for me, it's been like guys who I've kind of seen bubbling a little bit, like smaller artists that I like think are cool. Maybe I'll just DM them. I think for the MNNR tune, just this Italian producer, somebody actually put me onto them and said, oh, check this out. I reached out and he was like down to put it out. And yeah, other times like I'll play a track in my radio show and when I promote it, I'll tag them. And they'll be, oh, thanks for this. And then I'll be like, yo, send me some shit for my label. And they're down. I just signed this track from these kids that just was a DM, never heard of them at all. And it just went from that. So most, to be honest, 90% of it has been like on Instagram DMs. I don't know if that's just because I'm spend way too much time on Instagram that I'm checking my DMs like all the time and making sure like, I'm answering stuff on there, but that's what it's been for me for sure. And then once it gets to a point, usually even this last couple, I'll just like A&R the record on DM, be like, change this or tweak this. And then when they're like, okay, this is it, I'll be like, all right, send me an email. I'll connect everyone and do it. And we make it official from there.
Do you have any advice for that you've learned from your submitting over all these years and being on the other end of DMs or submissions of how to make that process go smoothly for young producers who want to get their tracks listened to or noticed? Is there anything you found when you're submitting that just makes it easier on the other side of the people reviewing or more?
You don't want to be annoying. That's for sure. I mean, you're at the mercy of these people. And, you know, I'm sure there's some people out there who think I'm a dick, like this guy didn't answer me or something. And it's, you know, there's a lot of emails and messages coming in all the fucking time. And, you know, but my experience has been more, I mean, granted, my first ever track that I ever put out was in, I didn't even know, I was still in Reason. And I it was like an email that I found online from Marcus Schultz and it took him 4 weeks to answer me and he ended up signing that track. But in my experience with like Steve Angelo, with Tiesto, it was putting out, luckily again, you know, I had established myself a little bit and it was putting out music that they ended up following me on Twitter. And then from there, emailing them or asking for their email. And then kind of that was how the connection was made, was through Twitter for both of them. So, yeah, I think it's just, you know, being persistent, but not being fucking annoying. Like if I didn't answer you and you send it five times, like that's not, don't send the same thing five times, you know, send another track and or to me or to whoever and hope they listen to that and then go from there. I think, you know, especially early on, there is such like a such exponential growth in this. And one thing I like kind of tell younger artists is just be patient. Like you Don't think your first track is going to be like the most revolutionary thing. It takes time, man. I've worked very hard at this for a long, long time. And it's important to remember that. And then another way that I think has always proven to be a way to get known is bootleg remixes. You know, you got to be a little more clever now than you needed to be like even 10 years ago, when you could just put up a bootleg on SoundCloud and it wouldn't get taken down or anything. But I think bootlegs are still really key. You know, I'm still looking for bootlegs. All DJs are going to be looking for bootlegs of stuff to play in festivals and things like that. So I think that's still a very important, a very, very good tool to use to get the attention of some of these bigger artists. You'll get a little bit of name recognition, then they'll be more inclined to check your stuff out and potentially sign something original.
On bootlegs, when you're making something or you get the idea to, or you're inspired, I heard you talking about the Tiesto being interested in, was it Ill Behavior? Was that the one on his? Oh, Steve Angelo. Clearing a sample like that, when you make a bootleg now, are you thinking at all, like, can I get this sample cleared? Or are you mostly just thinking, I want to make a great track because this is an awesome sample?
I'm thinking my management hates me for using samples. So I'm thinking when I get an idea like that, it's like, do I invest the time to turn this into something? Because what are the chances of it getting cleared? That's really the thing with, and it's something I still struggle with, you know, cause you're at the mercy of the original right holder. So number one, are they going to be cool with clearing it? Number two, what are they going to want? You know, I've had to pay some crazy advance fees, you know, on some of these things. And at the end of the day though, it's like, it's not your fucking idea. So I don't know if you curse on the show, so sorry.
It's all good.
It's not your original idea. So, you know, you have to clear it. There's a lot of tech house labels that just put shit up on Beatport and none of it's cleared and they just wing it. And if something gets big enough, it will get taken down. So, what the hell was the question? I'm just like rambling.
Yeah, I was, you answered it. I was wondering about you now being an established artist who's going to put out a certain number of tracks per year that you're probably targeting. How do you flirt between the bootleg, getting a cleared sample? It always amazes me to some extent how some other artists are not into their ideas being done, or at least remixed cost effectively. Like Justin Martin has this incredible remix of Bjork's The Anchor song, and I've only seen it on his recordings of live shows and things like that, but the track is beautiful, but he's reported that there's no way he's ever going to be able to release it. And so it just lives kind of in infamy, which to me is a bit of a shame. And I wish there was some way to figure that out. Is it usually a money thing on the other end, or is it like you're distorting my reputation or too much administrative hassle? Like what's the,
you know, or sampled, you know, I've definitely been in certain situations where it's like, no, they don't want to clear it. I took it up another notch on something I did recently where I didn't use one sample, I used two. My manager's like, are you fucking crazy? So the problem we ran into there was one. So now that's 200%, you know, as far as the publishing side of it, like that's impossible. And one of the samples, they're asking for 100%, you know, and the other one conceded to 50%, but the other one's still insisting on 100. So there's so many different factors. Like, is it, you know, I look at things a little different than most people. Like, I've been fortunate to have made some you know, over the last like 2 years, some decent income on the music side, on the streaming side. But I never really looked at it that way. Like, I want to make whatever the hell is going to get people to want to follow me and come to my shows, you know? So I don't care if I have to spend some money or the label has to spend it. And then I ended up having to recoup, you know, that money to the label. So yeah, like no was a crazy one because it was this TLC No Scrub sample. At first we're like, we're not going to be able to get this cleared. Let's just put it out as a free download kind of thing. We had made artwork for it as like a free download. And then I DM'd it to Tiesto before the Miami Music Week that year. I can't remember what year it was. And he wrote back. He's like, what are you doing with this? Like, I want to sign it. And I was like, well, like, I don't think we could clear it. You know, we're going to just give it out for free. He's like, no. He's like, send it. Like, let's set this up. Like, I'll help you clear it. We'll sign it to my label. I said, look, if you can get this thing cleared, sure. And it took, you know, Musical Freedom tried, and Musical Freedom is kind of has a similar deal with me with Spinning, where they're administered by Spinning. Spinning was trying to clear it, and they got nowhere for about 8 months. And I literally got the call from my, and it was like a constant follow up with their team. For like every fucking week, I'm like, what's up with this? For fucking like 8 months, they got to the Musical Freedom got to the point where they're like, probably got tired of me asking about it, and they were like, we're not getting anywhere with this, we got to drop it. And that same day, I had used this company that cleared Ill Behavior, which was Renegade Master sample, and I just called the guy and I'm like, dude, you help me clear that sample. And I had sampled this. I'm having trouble. He's like, oh, and it just was one of those things that it just like, I got lucky where this guy actually was managing TLC and like had administered Dallas Austin, who was one of the producers, like main producer at TLC. And that's how I got it cleared. But again, once you get to that point where they're like, yeah, we like this, we'll let you clear it. It's a whole negotiation there. That like there is no like, you know, guidelines to what you can ask for or what they're gonna want. So it gets to that point and then you're still at the mercy of them, and then you want to try to negotiate to kind of, you know, include yourself in that song. But it's one of those things where as far as my time, it's like I'll still do bootlegs though. Like if I think something is gonna pop, but it's like the chances of it. But for that stuff, it's usually like a newer song. So like when I did the Cardi B thing, it was just bubbling in clubs. Like my girlfriend was like, oh, like I'm hearing it like, you know, all the time. And I was like, oh, wow, that's kind of cool. So I did it then with the hopes that it would be one that would kind of pop. And then I had like one of the first remixes that DJs are going to want to, you know, seek out and play.
That makes a lot of sense. I've got only a couple more questions, probably, if you got time. On making those tracks, have you ever considered, or is it possible to recreate the sound using other people of, let's say you, for something like No, your track, where do you ever, now that you're more established, do you have the capability to get like vocal artists to pretty much do a cover that's very similar? I mean, some of these things don't seem that hard to recreate from maybe some extra work, but is anybody doing that in the industry?
Yeah, all the time. But so I know is technically a cover. So when it comes to clearing the rights to a song, there's the master side and the publishing side, right? The master side is owned, is a physical thing. So that master recording, you know, most artists don't ever retain the rights of their master recording, but they retain the rights of their publishing. So I could go to you and say, oh, I want to clear the song, but you say, oh, I have the publishing, but I don't have the master rights. So there's companies, TLC was a weird one because they had just finished one of these like made for TV documentaries where they ran into the problem with they wanted the music in the show and they didn't want to spend the money to clear it with all those original labels. So they re-sang the songs themselves. So I got these re-sung versions of the TLC songs from TLC. Most of the time though, it's you clear the publishing and then there's these companies that are like replay houses and like they have this insane Rolodex of singers or fucking bands. Like if you want to do a disco sample and they go and basically hand you back like something that sounds exactly like the original. And then you can go back, replace what was the original sample with this replayed version. And then you're clear. Yeah, there's definitely situations where people have also just said, oh, this is kind of the idea. It's a sample. I want to keep 100% of the rights. Let's just come up with something similar. But, you know, look at the trouble that like Pharrell has gotten into, you know, with, it's a kind of a slippery slope. If it's too close, you're going to get called out and you might get sued. So you got to be careful.
Yeah. That doesn't sound fun. When you're making your tracks, both for you and what you're putting out on the label, how much are you testing them in a club before release or a festival? How many times do you think you play before you get a sense of, yeah, this track is something I'm going to wrap up and submit?
First time, especially if it's something that's unknown. I mean, granted, it depends on if it's like a crowd that I know would be like kind of, if it's a good crowd and then I test it out and it works and like one time is enough. Sometimes if it maybe isn't a good crowd, it just kind of pops up there, another couple shots. But usually the first time it's like you kind of get that feeling, especially it's so different. Like I have a studio setup that I know really well. I know how it sounds, but when you're in a DJ booth and you're playing 10 records and then in between those 10, you play your own and you're like, wow, that sonically fit perfectly with everything else I played. I got that checked off. And then you see the reaction. It's like, okay, this thing, nobody knows this thing. But people are reacting to it. And I think more so in the last, like, you know, we went through this phase where I think people went out expecting what to hear, you know, like they like wanted to hear, they wanted to know every fucking record, every song. And now I think we're in this phase where like people want to be surprised. So I think it's that the reactions have gotten bigger for like something they don't know. So it's become easier to be like, okay, yeah, this one is like the one, you know. And a lot of it too is I'll play it in a couple of shows and people will tweet about it or DM me, be like, what was this? And I'll be like, okay, that's a good sign.
For some tracks, ones I just heard, your new one, Dolce, and Fisher, the two he just released, Freaks and Wanna Go Dancing, heard those for a long time before they actually got released. What is happening in between the first play? Is it to build the excitement for the track in out, or is it the legal stuff or some combination of all of that?
I think for, you know, I thought about this a lot for Fisher. Losing it was just so big and it just kept growing, right? So when you have that happen, you have a lot of pressure of like, what are you going to put out next? If it's not as big, is your career going down? So I think again, Fisher is a different style artist. Like, it's propelled him to this level because the music is so good. But he, as a personality, is just like tenfold of most artists. So I think, I don't know. I mean, I think in his situation, I had gotten, somebody sent me, which I probably shouldn't have, that the EP like long before it came out. So I'm under the impression it was maybe something that was planned to come out much sooner. But because losing it just kept going and they didn't put anything else out. In my situation with Dolce, it was kind of about finding the right time to put it out, going through the process of clearing the sample, And yeah, and then, you know, putting it out, planning to put it out around when it will help the touring side more because it's a club record. So those are kind of the factors for me.
And so my last one's a two-parter. It sounds like a lot of the breaks in your career have come from conversations you've had and relationships you've developed at music events. One, if you're touring a lot, how does that happen? And where are you going to? And also, I guess, if you can name top three clubs or that you've been to around the world in the last 3 years that you really like.
The first question, I think early on, obviously it's online, but then, you know, my experience, there's Miami and ADE are still really important pieces to this. And I think I've met artists who, you know, maybe weren't doing much, didn't pop for a few years, but I met them in person just out partying. So I think a lot of like the inner community, like, relationships DJ to DJ, I think are done, especially in Miami, because, you know, you're playing all these shows. Nobody's doing really any meetings or business. It's just DJs who go DJ and then go party and hang out with other DJs. So a lot of relationships, I think, were made there. Festivals, you know, I'm not, you know, I try to kind of spend my time having fun, obviously, but also like if there's someone there that I want to meet, like I'm going to go out of my way to make sure I've kind of, you know, and it can go two ways. If it's somebody too big, they could totally ghost you and it'll ruin your perception of them forever. Luckily that hasn't necessarily happened, but this summer, I mean, on the positive note, I forget what festival I was playing, but Steve Aoki was playing and he was one guy that just like, I don't think, I knew I was on his radar. He probably played a bunch of the stuff that I did with like Don Diablo, but I was with somebody who like knew his tour manager or somebody, and I was able to meet him. And right away he's like, oh, you're Sid. Like, oh dude, great to meet you. Like, let's make some music. And it turned into now us potentially having a collab that hopefully will come out at some point. I think a lot of it is people want to be your friend, you know, especially in the underground side. Like the underground is just all about who these guys fuck with and like, are you in their crew, you know? Because it's more about the party. So you really need to be like in with these guys if they're going to put you on. You know, I have a friend who is a crazy example. Like he was like one of the few big New York open format DJs. And then before EDM popped, he was like, oh, this is the thing. And he's like, I helped him early on with producing and he had like, you know, a go at that and toured a lot. And then he got to the point where he was just like, he's like, I hate this music now. And like started doing underground before kind of underground popped. And it took him a really long time to kind of get in those circles. And a big part of it was he's got like this sick loft or hat before he had the sick loft. It was like legendary in Manhattan, like right in Meatpacking. And he would throw these after hours and like would have Marco Carolla come DJ in his house, in his loft, and have like, you know, Nick Fanciulli, Jamie Jones. So he got himself in these circles by being like the guy that like people would after party with in New York. And he's like, he's actually an insane producer. And it took him years to kind of, you know, kind of get himself in there and now start releasing on like Hot Creations and I think he did some stuff on Martinez Brothers Cutting Heads label too. So yeah, dude, everything is relationship based, 100%. Mm. You know, that's why managers are there. If you're an artist who, you know, I don't think I'm the greatest people person. I think producers can be kind of semi introverted, some more than others. I'm luckily where I'm like somewhere in this weird middle ground where I could still have a conversation most of the time with people. But yeah, a lot of this is things that managers can be doing. If a manager believes in you and has the connections, they'll be able to get your music to where you need to go.
Yeah, and I guess to close on the second part, I've now found that asking two-part questions never works on a podcast. But best clubs, top three.
Top three. I want to say Echo Stage in D.C. I want to say this club called, which it's not even a club, it's like a permanent festival in Brazil. It's called La Rock. And third, I don't know.
I guess we could just stick with the top two, but what makes them kind of the memorable?
Echo Stage is just like they found the perfect balance of like feeling like a club, but it being like a giant warehouse kind of, you know, it's like a 5,000 cap or maybe a little less, like three or four venue. It's just like they were managed to keep that vibe. And then La Rock is just, I played there a couple years ago and it's just like the most insane production and place like ever. And it's just like this giant, it looks like, you know, like the Coachella stage. That's like one of those like arc. It's literally that, but it's just there all year long. And it's people go every weekend and just, it's like tons of people. And at number three, I would probably say Avant Gardner, Brooklyn Mirage in New York. Just because it's like what they've been able to build there. And they really, you know, New York for a long time was missing that like community. You know, when we had Pasha, which is a legendary club, there was that community where like, you know, maybe the average fan didn't speak to them, but like you knew the people who ran it. And I feel like there is that community of people there like that have like helped bring that back to New York, you know? So that's probably top three.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks, man.
I learned a lot. This was so cool.
Thanks.
I really appreciate it.
It was fun. Thanks for having me.
Have a good one, man.
You
be
too,
well.
Later.
Thanks for listening to the episode, and a special thank you to Sean Fleischer, one half of the NYC-based duo Pool House, for answering some of my questions about DJing and getting started producing prior to recording with Sid. One piece of advice Sean offered for new artists was to be thoughtful about who you send your demos to and how you send them. It may be tempting to put out everything you make to every label you like at the beginning, but restraint pays off. Labels want to get an exclusive look or at least feel like they aren't on some distribution list. When you really have a whole song to send that you're proud of, pick a label that you think it'll resonate with and reach out. When sending a private SoundCloud link or other file share mechanism, make sure that the play count is low and keep the wording direct and focused to how you fit with the label. One thing that's clear after talking to Sid and Sean is the music business is just as much about building relationships as it is the music. Getting the right team in place to turn a hot track into enduring relationships with collaborators, promoters, and marketers is a way to turn passion into a career.